An old book. A book about witchcraft.
You're listening to the Whitewood Podcast, a show about mystery schools, the occult, and witchcraft.
Would you like to have a look around?
Why have you come to Whitewood?
Well, because I'm interested in witchcraft.
I'm your host, Nate. Come with us as we delve into the history, techniques, and backstories of these traditions and the people who practice them.
Welcome back to the Whitewood Podcast. My name is Nate Driscoll, and this week we are going to be talking about the tarot. Now, the tarot is an incredibly large topic and often overlaps other ideas. Some of them we've already touched on. We've already done a couple of episodes on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. We've already done some episodes on things like the elements and the planets and those types of things. And so when it comes to the tarot, there's always going to be a lot of overlap with other hermetic ideas. And because of that, it's a small topic that expands out quite a bit very quickly. And so what we're going to need to do in order to tackle a topic this size is we're definitely going to need to split it into a couple of different categories. And so this episode, what we're going to be doing is digging into the history of the tarot. Tarot-like cards, the actual tarot themselves, as well as like the fortune-telling system that derives from the existence of the cards, because oddly enough, the cards came around a little bit earlier. And then we're going to touch a little bit on tarot today. What that actually looks like in a modern sense. Now, we're also going to probably want to do an episode where we talk about some of the more symbolic side of tarot. Now, that's going to have to come a little bit down the road. And basically what that's going to look like is we're going to break down some of the stuff like the Fool's Journey, some of the specific cards. I imagine we won't really have time to dig into all of the individual cards. Of course, that is something that people are interested in. Please let me know, and we can definitely put that more seriously on the books. But for right now, we're talking about the history of the tarot. So first off, what is the tarot? Well, Webster's defines the tarot. And I would argue that this definition is not fantastic. It works really good for a very surface level entry to it, which a lot of definitions are, especially in dictionaries. But Webster's defines it as any of a set of usually 78 playing cards, including 22 pictorial cards used for fortune telling. However, I don't feel like that truly paints the whole picture. What they seem to have described here to me is what's called cartomancy. Now, cartomancy is the method of using divination via cards, and it can be all sorts of different cards. That's kind of a large umbrella term. I would say that some of the things that are in their definition are kind of accurate. How tarot cards are usually 78 playing cards and usually have 22 pictorial cards. I would say that that's probably pretty accurate. But the idea of it being a wider berth than that, I do think that it's important for us to, for the sake of this episode, start to draw a little bit of a line on what cartomancy is and its various forms for two major reasons. Number one, tarot's history standing alone is very extensive. But I think the other reason is that a lot of other cartomancy often gets kind of swept under the rug because tarot is very widely known. A lot of people are aware of it. It can be hard for other versions of cartomancy or other forms of divination even to be able to present themselves as options. And so I do feel like that definition falls a little short because it so closely resembles a definition of cartomancy, saying that, you know, you're using playing cards for divination or using words like usually. So we are going to have to kind of dive a little bit more specifically into the tarot itself. Now, tarot is interesting because it has a lot of myths about its origin. I've heard it come from many, many different sources, but the most common mythical source is that of the ancient Egyptians. And we'll have to talk a little bit about that myth when it comes up in the timeline in order to really understand that claim and where it had come from and why it's so prevalent even today that we hear that the ancient Egyptians were the ones that invented tarot. It is also really interesting that it has so many myths about its origins, because tarot itself does arrive at a period of time when we have pretty solid archaeological evidence. We have pretty solid record keeping. It is well into recorded history that the tarot starts to pop out. And because of that, we have very concise evidence as to when it had shown up. And we also have its predecessors. We also have the things that it sort of emerged out of. You would have one playing card game that eventually became another as they added a couple of rules, or they added a couple of cards, or a different manufacturer produced cards. And so when they did that, they added some stuff for their own flair. And because of this, we can actually see tarot emerge very, very slowly as it, you know, starts to take form and shape that we see today. That's very contrast to most of the things that we talk about on this show. Many of the topics that we talk about on this show, we have to say, you know, we're not really sure exactly where it came from. We don't have specific years and specific individuals. But we know that these are some of the major players once it got to these cultures. And so I do think that it's really interesting that of all the different stuff that we have on this show, the tarot seems to have the most mythical origins that are often touted as if they are fact, when in fact we know exactly where these things really came from. So for the sake of the episode, how are we defining tarot? We're going to define it in a lot more of a modern definition. We're going to say that tarot is a very specific form of cartomancy. Cartomancy being any of the forms of divination with playing cards or any kind of cards. We're going to be saying that tarot is a specific set of standard associations for those cards. The 78 cards are going to include 22 trump cards, which are also sometimes called the major arcana, and 56 minor arcana cards, which are divided into four suits and two different categories. Those two categories of the minor arcana are going to be numbered cards like the Four of Wands or the Two of Discs or things like that. And then the court cards. The court cards are going to be things, depending on which deck you're looking at, they might be things like the Knight of Discs, or the you might have King and Queen of Swords, or you might find that you have Page or Princess, or those types of things. But they're usually all of the court cards. There's going to be they're going to be split into the four categories, which are going to be your pentacles or coins, depending on the deck. It's going to be your wands, your swords, and your cups, right? And this is also true for the numbered cards. But then there will be four of them. And so there will sometimes be knight, queen, prince, princess, or knight, queen, page, princess, or king, queen, knight, page, or things like that. There's always four of them, and there's some really interesting tie-ins as to why. But that gives us a lot more standard of a definition as we move forward into exploring this. Now, you will notice that the minor arcana is incredibly similar to a standard playing deck made of 52 cards. if you've ever played poker or go fish or something like that with just a standard playing deck, you'll notice that it's incredibly similar to what we're describing as the minor arcana, and that is for good reason. They are also divided into four suits, and they also have numbered and court cards as well. Those court cards also, there are four of them. You could make an argument that there are five based on the fact that the ace could either be interpreted as a court card or be interpreted as the one. Either way, the very, very similar breakdown. Now, in our definition, we're purposefully leaving out oracle cards. Now, oracle cards are also used for cartomancy and are often sold in the same shops right alongside tarot decks. And you've probably seen them. You know, I own a couple myself. You know, there are decks like the Crystal Fairy deck or the Angel Oracle deck or something spooky like the Vampire Witch deck or those types of things. I do want to say, since we're on the topic, that these are perfectly valid forms of cartomancy. We're leaving them out of this episode because they lack the historical context, which we find in the more formalized set of tarot as we dig through the history of them. But as far as actually using them for divination, let's say you are feeling especially emotionally connected to one particular oracle deck and you get really good results out of it, great, keep using it. That's awesome. You know, I do think that it is a perfectly valid form of divination. I have found that often those decks, they lack a central structure that carries over from one to another the way that the tarot specifically does. And so it does make it really, really hard to dig through the historical context in any way other than saying, here's an artist's interpretation of cartomancy that was inspired by the tarot. And so use them by all means, you know, if it's your will to do so. But we are going to be leaving them out of our definition on purpose here as we dig through some of this history. Now, you'll notice that we did include tarot decks in our definition, which follow the format of the cards, even if the artwork has been themed. I do want to make a pretty serious difference between saying anything that's running with a specific theme is an oracle deck. I don't think that that is the case. As long as it's following that standard format of 78 cards, 22 trumps, and 56 minor arcana cards, then I would include that within the tarot for the sake of this discussion, right? That would be like in the case of like the Tarot Cats deck or, you know, things like that where an artist has sat down. It's a fun art theme. The pictures have been interpreted by the artist, but the overall meaning of each one of their cards, their number, and the category has stayed intact. Now, there are some decks that we'll talk about that change the meaning of one or two to better suit the ideology or teachings of a group. And because they mostly follow the same format, we're going to include them in here as well. We'll dig into that near some of the end of this story as we kind of tie it all together. So let's kind of dig into it now. The divination via cards has been around basically as long as there have been playing cards. And before that, there have been plenty of games which have also been used for divination. A common example that comes to mind is cleromancy, where something like lots or dice are used for generating a random outcome, and then the fortune of the individual is derived from that random generation. And this is incredibly common. Basically, what ends up happening is in the old world, types of games would become cultural icons, culturally available. And as the pieces for those games became available, the pieces were often used for divinatory purposes. And you could dig in a lot as to why. It is really difficult to say why that's a really common thing to happen. Nowadays, I don't see it as much. You know, I've never seen somebody, like, try to do divination with, like, Cards Against Humanity or Monopoly or, you know, like, there's all these really cultural games that exist now. And I've never once, well, I shouldn't say never once. I've never seen somebody, like, seriously dive into the fortune telling using those types of things. But it was a really, really common thing for a long time that anytime one of these games became prominent, it would become that type of a thing. Now, that's not to say that all divination is derived from games, but a great deal of the forms of divination can be tracked back to making game pieces widely available for the masses. So tarot, like many other forms of divination, starts in a pretty similar way as a game, and in particular a card game. One of the earliest card games that was ever recorded, and the oldest which we still know the rules, was the Chinese gambling game called Mai Diao. Now, in this game, players used paper money, and they were in the form of cards because gambling was illegal. And so the different card games, or the different cards played a role in the game, and were divided into four suits, and then nine coins and nine strings of coins. Now, this game goes back to the 13 to 1400s, but there are several other games which span back a few hundred years earlier, so by no means was this the first game. But it's one of the earliest card games, and definitely one that already in the timeline we can see some of that format of the tarot start to emerge with the four suits, as well as the card aspect of that game. And it is one of the oldest card games that we still have the rules today that survive to a modern period. Tarot-like card games start to appear in an Italian card game from the 13th to 15th century. And this is widely due to the invention of the paper mill in 1215 and block printing methods making its way into Europe in 1370. Woodblock printing had been used in China for hundreds of years. Woodblock printing was really slow to be adopted into Europe. And while it was not incredibly common for entire books to be block printed, playing cards were very common to be produced in this method. Still very expensive to produce a deck of playing cards. And because of that, it was very much wrapped into a status symbol. You know, if you could afford to have printed playing cards, then you were obviously well off, and so it was one of those types of things. Moving a little bit forward on the timeline, there's a game called Mermuk, or Niabi. And it's the same game. It goes by a couple of different names depending on the culture that's playing it, and that would have popped up in around 1370. It's an Arabic card game. It uses four suits, although they are not named as such. They are the same four suits. They are reminiscent of the same four suits. What they had named them was scimitars, polo sticks, multitudes, and coins. Now, scimitars we see, you know, taking that role of swords, polo sticks of wands. Multitudes was depicting a cup. And then coins, of course, is your coin or disc suit. And so very, very early on, we see, long before the tarot has officially become the tarot, we see this emergent of card games being divided into these same four suits. The Italians, when they came across Mermuk, they rethemed these decks to make them make more European sense. And they would they introduced the Italian version of the game with the Italian version of the suits, which was coins, wands or clubs, cups, and swords. And so Mermuk definitely holds a really important role as it starts to emerge into the tarot. Eventually, we get to the 1400s. In about 1440, there was a game called Triumphi. Now, Triumphi translates to triumphs, and that's also where we get the word trump when we talk about a trump card or the major arcana cards. And A triumph is like a parade. It's basically a parade for the generals and the aristocracy after a large battle. Petrarch writes a poem called I Triumphi in 1356, and this poem goes over the idea of a triumph parade, and each of these archetypal characters come in triumphing over the last. The game Triumphi is not tarot, but is included in this list because it's very, very tarot-similar. Triumphi was heavily influenced by the game of Niobe, and the game Triumphi includes 16 trump cards, 4 suits, and 40 what they call pip cards, or the numbered cards. Now, the trump cards in this case, they were made of Greek gods and goddesses like Bacchus or Ceres or Apollo. And I think this is really interesting because we already start to see in this line the mystic enter the discussion, as well as the idea of these like great archetypal forces being present in the representation of the cards. The pip cards, the 40 pip cards, were in 4 suits and were represented by different kinds of birds. So they called these birds the 4 different categories were called the virtues, the riches, the countenance, and the pleasure. They were represented by, virtues was represented by the eagle, riches was represented by the phoenix, continence was represented by the turtle dove, and pleasure was represented by the dove. And you can definitely read into that a little bit deeper if you want to look at like some elemental associations that are there. Although I do think that it gets a little strange because you do have riches being associated to the phoenix, which makes it really difficult to pull out like a really concrete which of the 4 elements is which, because riches would usually be something that we would find in the element of earth, whereas a phoenix being a bird of fire would be something we would usually associate with fire. So you can kind of see how that 4 suits is and is not there at that time. But Triumphi is really, really interesting because it is the emergence of the trump cards and the emergence of these archetypal forces being represented on there. I would definitely say that if somebody's trying to understand how this all started, while it's not tarot, reading through Petrarch's poem, I Triumphi, definitely, there are translations, it's written in Italian, but can definitely start to connect the idea of what a triumph parade is, and these idea of the of each card kind of triumphing over the last, which eventually does start to create this idea of like almost like the fool's journey of, you know, and we'll dig that in a different episode to kind of dive into it more specifically. Eventually, Triumphi is incredibly popular, and it only takes about 10 years for Triumphi in Italy to sort of start to merge into another game, shift into another game. And I do think that it's an interesting time period because if we bought a playing deck today, there would be many uses of that playing deck. You know, there's a lot of culturally recognizable games that you could play. There's, you know, 15 different versions of poker that you could play. There's games like Go Fish and those types of things. And just a huge plethora of those types of things. But because the standard playing deck wasn't the only thing around at that time, what was happening is as new games were being invented, new decks were being printed. And so we see both an emergence of new playing cards as well as emergence of new games happening pretty simultaneously. So one example of that in the 1450s, so about 10 years after Triumphi, is Tarocchi or Tarocchini. The name Triumphi shifts over to Tarocchi in Ferrara and Avignon. Now, the name Triumphi starts to become the description of this new game. in a lot of areas. But then it also starts to kind of split off into this new game. Eventually, we do start to see cards like the World or the Emperor card creep into the regional decks, which pop up as this game evolves. It's in Bologna, Italy, that we see a regional Triumphi deck pop up and start to become this new game. And this deck is much, much more similar to what we would call a tarot deck today. By this point, Tarocchi, as well as Triumphi, have been heavily influenced by the game of Marmok. And by this period, many decks contain either the four suits or the standard system in playing cards like hearts, diamonds, spades, and clubs. We do start to see that in this time period. Many Triumphi, Tarocchi, and Tarocchini decks include these four suits at this time. And while this period is very similar to a tarot deck, it still lacks the same number of cards and the same number of trump cards. But many of the cards are what we would see in a tarot deck as this shift starts to happen. By 1466, there's a variation on Triumphi, which originates in Florence, Italy. It's called Minciati, and it uses 97 cards. Now, Minciati comes from the word nonsense, which makes a lot of sense in regards to the fool card. And in a lot of ways, this is where we start to see the emergence of that fool concept. So there's 41 trump cards that are in a Minciati deck, and many of them have their own way, have in their own way made their way into modern tarot decks. I wouldn't say all of them, obviously, because we've slimmed down to only 22. But these decks have some extra major arcana cards, such as each one of the zodiac being presented as its own card. So you would have like the card of Pisces or the card of Aries or those types of things. And then it also has each one of the four elements. So you would have a card for fire, a card for water. And then there are also some that just didn't make their way into the standard tarot, like the card of hope or the card of fortitude or the hunchback. And then they also had five cards that were, they were very similar to each other. They depicted different individuals, but they were the five Pope cards after, you know, created after the popes. The five Pope cards have been changed over the years to be relating to the Lover's card, the Emperor and the Empress, the Magician, and the Hierophant card. So we do see, now, there is some really interesting stuff that happens with the High Priestess card in some later decks. But at one point, and we'll talk about that deck in a little bit, the High Priestess card is actually the Pope-ess, as in a female pope. There was some mythology back in the day that there had been a female pope. And I think, as far as I've understood, I have never seen really solid evidence that that actually historically happened. But there was, for a long time, a myth that it had happened. And so there was this quite a bit of interesting stuff as we start to see these cards either get dropped out of the deck or change in theme slightly while keeping a lot of the meaning the same. It's really interesting. So now we're at like 1490. Now in 1490, a very, very important tarot deck pops up called the Sola Busca deck. Now the Sola Busca deck is the oldest surviving 78 card tarot deck. And I would very much include this in being tarot. However, the trump cards are a little different. They go through more historical figures than the actual trumps as we see them today. But it was a 78 card deck. There are some older decks which are incomplete that are still kind of in this category. An example of that might be the Visconti deck. One of the other things that makes the Sola Busca deck incredibly interesting to me is that all of the minor cards, all the minor arcana, are fully illustrated. This is interesting for two major reasons. It's much more expensive to do that. And there were not a lot of decks around that were doing anything close to that. But another reason why it's really interesting is that some of the meaning that we derive to some of the minor arcana are taken from the Sola Busca deck's illustrations. And several of them, a perfect example, if you have the time to look it up, is the Three of Hearts. The Three of Hearts artwork has remained mostly the same well into a modern period from this Sola Busca deck, where it depicts, it's the Three of Swords. It depicts a heart with three swords sticking through it. And a lot of meaning for the Three of Swords is derived from that particular illustration. And so we start to see some of these meanings pop in at that point. Now, the surviving Sola Busca deck is currently at the Brera Museum in Milan, Italy. It is still protected to this day. I'm not sure if they still have it on display. I know it's in their collection and it is often on display. And in this deck, there are 21 numbered trump cards and one unnumbered trump card. The 21, and this is something that also kind of carries over into modern decks, is that the Fool card is in the Sola Busca completely unnumbered, but in a lot of modern decks, like the a lot of the standard decks will do this. So like the Rider-Waite deck will do this, where the Fool card is numbered, but it's numbered zero. And that ties back into both the ideas of Minciati and also the Sola Busca's numbering system. Now, many of these cards have inspired later depictions. And so if you're really into the history of the artwork, the Sola Busca deck is a fantastic one to kind of dig through in order to see. Now, moving forward a little bit to 1507, we see the oldest reference to France producing cards in the city of Lyons, which is the closest major city, is Milan. And France and Switzerland by the 1507 are regularly playing the Italian card games. Trade routes, trade of culture has been pretty prominent over those past couple hundred years. And France starts producing their own cards. In 1534, Rabelais writes a book called Five Books of Gargantua and Pantagruel. And he lists over 200 different card games, including one which he calls Tarot. Now, he spells Tarot T-A-R-A-U, and he does, in this book, list numerous different divinatory methods using cards, but tarot is not included as one of those. It's just the publication of the rules of the card game tarot, and the spelling is not what we would expect to see. So it looks like the card game tarot starts to kind of appear around this period, but that it has not yet made its way into a divinatory method. And I think this is really interesting because while some other card games include divination at this time, the methods of tarot divination had not quite made their way to Paris. Fast forwarding a little bit to 1575, tarot becomes its own card game in Venice. And this is where we see our first printed account of the card game tarot. By the 1700s, the game Tarot has several variations, such as French Tarot. And often, this French Tarot game is what I will hear as the origin point of Tarot. But I would argue that because Rabelais writes it a little bit earlier, just spelled differently, that the card game itself probably existed before that. Now, this period, the 1700s, is the game at its height and will be its height for several more hundred years. Divination exists for the card game in the 1700s, and several authors have written poems of the trump cards. And in 1736, Chausson of Marseille... So the Marseille duck shows up in 1736, and there are very few cards that are different from what they are today. The only real major changes on the Marseille deck is that it does have a couple of different names for a few cards, like the Popess, which, as we mentioned, eventually becomes the High Priestess. The Tower card. And I think it warrants saying that these cards that that have different names, it, for the most part, it really is just the names that have changed by this time. The depictions of the cards are pretty much the same, right? So the High Priestess card has a lot of different elements that you would see looking at the Popess card. There's another card called the House of God, which is a depiction of a tower that's being struck and is collapsing, which eventually becomes the Tower card. Another example that I don't think this one has completely faded out yet. I do still see decks produced that have this card. Many cards have already made the change on this one, but the Juggler card eventually becomes the Magician. And so in the Marseille deck, it is the Juggler. I think it's interesting to note that in the Marseille deck, the Fool card is still an unnumbered card, which we saw from the Solabusca deck in 1490, nearly 250 years earlier. And even though the artwork is very recognizable, down to the details like the Juggler is standing at a table while the Magician card stands at a very similarly laid out table, or the House of God card with the House of God card, you could basically write the Tower at the bottom of it and it would look almost exactly the same. This Marseille deck ends up becoming very popularized as the standard divinatory set by individuals like Eliphas Levi and several other authors. By 1770, Jean-Baptiste Alliet, also known as Attila. Attila is Alliet spelled backwards. He published books under his own last name and then just spelled it backwards. I love it. So Jean-Baptiste Alliet, in 1770, he publishes a book on the topic called How to Entertain Yourself with a Pack of Playing Cards, which is the first published, widely distributed manual on reading tarot. And then he publishes several other books on the tarot during this time. And eventually in 1783, he publishes another book with almost the same title, which drives me insane. If there's any authors listening to this, especially hundreds of years down the road, hopefully your work has survived. And if your work becomes prominent enough to switch languages as it's translated into other tongues, trying to differentiate two books that have almost the same title is incredibly complicated. So do future researchers a solid and name your books very individually from each other. It really does help us. And I genuinely do hope that, you know, any authors that are listening do publish and that their works do survive the time and are influential enough to be translated in multiple languages. That's fantastic. And I wish you the best. So he publishes another book by almost the same title, How to Amuse Oneself with the Deck of Cards Called Tarots. And so it's the same title. He just has specified which deck of playing cards, which makes it kind of frustrating, especially if you're trying to use a search engine in order to isolate which book it is, and you're using terms like tarot in your search. Man, it is hard to find the different copies. In this book, he makes a claim that survives to this day. And Jean-Baptiste Alliet is really interesting because he's one of the first, like, professional tarot readers and publishers. And so he makes this claim, and because he's so influential on tarot for hundreds of years, because he's the first to be doing one of these types of things, this claim still lives to this day. And it's the claim that that the tarot have ancient Egyptian origins. Some of that has to do with the time period. 1770, 1783, we're getting really, really close to the fascination that exists with the ancient Egyptian empire. And it sells really, really well. And we've seen a lot of authors during this time period and the time period that comes directly after it make all sorts of ancient Egyptian claims. It's very prominent. And it just has to do with that time period being very interested in that culture, right? So this claim was not original by any means. However, it when he says it, it becomes much more of a mainstream idea. The Antoine Court de Gebelin had already made the claim, and there's nothing to support the claim. You would imagine that, especially with how much research has gone into ancient Egypt, both during the period where, you know, Great Britain is really big on that, and the museum culture is really big on that, we would have found any shred of evidence for either the symbols popping up in their artwork or a partial deck. I mean, if we found a single card from an ancient Egyptian tomb or something like that, then that would change my opinion on this. Or if we found like a depiction that was clear to not be something that inspired a later artistic depiction. Maybe if we had like, I don't know, like Horus or something sitting in a particular card artwork on some form of Egyptian tomb wall or something like that. That would definitely change my opinion. But as of right now, there are not any archaeologically verifiable support for such a claim. In fact, Eliphas Levi would later criticize this claim, as well as much of Jean-Baptiste Eliette's work. I will also say about Jean-Baptiste Eliette, he also produces some stuff that later authors pull inspiration on and almost kind of like steamroll in the historical record. Like, he wrote a book called The Book of Thoth, being a book trying to tie the Egyptian god Thoth of writing the ibis-headed bird into the tarot concept. Aleister Crowley later writes a book called The Book of Thoth and produces a deck of cards called the Thoth deck. And that was also something that Attila had done tie in those ideas. Now, Crowley's work is unique to Eliette's cards and artwork and published work. Crowley tends to take a much more Kabbalistic direction with it. But this claim also ends up kind of overlapping with this idea, this belief that the Kabbalistic Tree of Life had come from the Egyptian courts, the Egyptian religion, because here you have this well-established author claiming that the tarot are coming back from them, and then later people start to go, hey, have you guys noticed the similarities here with the Kabbalistic Tree of Life? And so later that claim kind of evolves into this idea that the Tree of Life itself had come from ancient Egypt. It's not a very historically valid claim. Okay, so off my ranting high horse and on to, so that's 1770 and 1783 that we see those two books published. Moving on, quite a big of a jump to 1856 in Paris. There is a man named Eliphas Levi. Well, he was not named Eliphas Levi. There is a man who publishes his work under the name Eliphas Levi. His name was Alphonse Louis Constant. He lived in Paris and published a book called Dogma et Ritual. I have the English translation in front of me, and I don't remember the full Dogma et Ritual. The English translation is Dogma and Ritual of Transcendental Magic. Now, those were actually published as two separate works. He published them as Dogma of Transcendental Magic, and then Ritual of Transcendental Magic was a second book. If you buy this book now, it is almost always published together as Dogma and Ritual of Transcendental Magic. And in it, Levi paints tarot as absolutely instrumental towards occult and transcendental teachings. This book would later go on to, and much of Levi's work would also later go on to heavily influence traditions like the Golden Dawn, the OTO, and the AA, as well as occultists like Samuel Mathers, Aleister Crowley, Arthur Edward Waite, and really, I would argue, ceremonial magic as a whole for well into today. Are very much influenced by Eliphas Levi's work. I would say the tone has changed in ceremonial magic quite a bit since Dogma and Ritual had come out. And while much of the technique, ideas, some of the formalized ways that we go about ceremonial magic is pretty similar, some of the ideology and the dogmatic tie to older religions like Christianity or Judaism, those types of things, has at least in some way faded. You know, there is still some tie to a lot of those ideas, but its grip has lessened quite a bit. And we do see ceremonial magic kind of take its own stride nowadays. English occultist Kenneth Mackenzie comes into play in this period with Eliphas Levi because Mackenzie had visited Levi in Paris and later wrote a text that this is a difficult one to make a definite statement. He is rumored to be the author of a text and often taught to be the author of a text. However, we're not entirely sure if it was him, but that seems to be where it has come from, according to the records of some later occultists who knew Mackenzie. He writes a text called The Cipher Manuscript and another called Book T, which later becomes, both The Cipher Manuscript and Book T later become the basis for tarot teachings in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And tarot teachings were very central in the teachings of the Golden Dawn, down to the point where, like, for example, some of the ideas of the Golden Dawn initiations are taken directly from superimposing the tarot cards onto the Kabbalistic Tree of Life and saying, like, hey, at this particular stage, you are standing here on the Tree of Life, and so if you look to your left, you'll see this card, and if you look to your right, you'll see this card, and so it's important for you to stand on this particular position. Obviously, all of that, those initiations have been well published and discussed, and so I don't think that I'm releasing any spoilers there. But an example of that, if you wanted to kind of dig through that information, is Israel Regardi wrote a book where he published the Stella Matutina's initiations, which were taken from their... The Stella Matutina was a splinter off of the Golden Dawn after it had fallen apart, and so they did take a great deal of their work from the Golden Dawn, including their initiatory rites. And so there's a lot of really interesting things with Levi and Mathers and the Golden Dawn and the OTO and Crowley and Waite, and all of these individuals really do get a lot of their teachings start to emerge out of the tarot. And I think that's a really interesting thing. Eventually, this cipher manuscript makes its way to William Westcott and Samuel Mathers, and they end up launching the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn after acquiring Mackenzie's papers. The cipher manuscript in particular is a really big one. Fast forwarding a little bit to 1909. Now, in 1909, Arthur Edward Waite publishes what we now know as the standard tarot deck in every respect of the idea. If you've ever received just the I don't want to call it entry level, because it's a valid tarot deck. It does a pretty good job. Just the standard AE Rider-Waite deck, that has become the staple deck in a lot of situations. And a lot of artwork, even to this day, if you buy a different deck, is going to be based on that particular deck. You're also going to see a lot of the meanings be derived from this particular deck. It was called the Rider-Waite deck because of the Rider Publishing Company, and Arthur Edward Waite had been a major force in creating the deck. However, Waite was not an artist. He did not paint those cards. And so often, unfortunately, the actual artist does not get her time in the limelight for her depictions of these cards. We are going to bring her up and talk a little bit about her. Not a whole lot, but at least point out some interesting things. Now, Waite was a student of the Golden Dawn, and so a lot of his understandings of the tarot cards, the interpretations of those cards, what types of things should be depicted on the cards, a lot of those types of things came from the Golden Dawn's teachings, which then we can trace back to the Mackenzie papers, which then we can trace back to Eliphas Levi, and that, of course, Levi had commented quite heavily on Jean-Baptiste Alliette's work. And so you can see this, like, passing on from one group to another as this really starts to unfold into a divinatory and mystic practice. Now, Waite, as I have said, did not illustrate the cards. The art was actually done by another member of the Golden Dawn. Her name was Pamela Coleman Smith. And if you ever look at the cards, almost all of the trump cards in the Arthur Edward Waite have this strange sigil, squiggly line looking thing. And what it is it's Pamela Coleman Smith's signature, similar to how you would sign a painting. It is a sigil-like image, and it is made from the letters P, C, and S for Pamela Coleman Smith. And I have looked at that particular layout a couple of times. I have some of these cards printed and on my wall, and you can see her initials still there. One of them, I had to edit the card in order to fit in the frame of the particular picture. And I actually went into Photoshop, brought her signature, which would have been cut off by the cropping, and move it over back into the image so that we could preserve her claim to that artwork, which I thought was a fun thing to do to try to keep it alive a little bit. You will now see a lot of groups have started to, instead of calling this the Rider-Waite deck, they will call this the Rider-Waite-Smith deck or the Waite-Smith deck. And I think that's a cool way to bring it back in, to bring her back into the discussion. You know, she was also an occultist, was also taught by the Golden Dawn, and it's unfortunate that, you know, just for what I assume is just for being a woman, in that time period, for her to not get the claim to it the way that, you know, Arthur Edward Waite does. I would say something that interesting that Pamela Coleman Smith did was that she was heavily inspired by the Solobusca deck and the Marsal deck. And so she goes back through those two decks And her artwork is very inspired by that. And it's really due to her that we see cards like the Three of Swords maintain its illustration all the way back to the Sola Busca deck, because she was very inspired by that and was digging through those ancient decks in order to decide how to paint certain things. She obviously takes her own artistic style in all of this. By no means would I suggest that she's just ripping off an earlier idea, but she's obviously very heavily inspired by these traditional sources. And so because of that, a lot of the ancient artwork from tarot and tarot-similar art makes its way into modern tarot, because this deck becomes the standard staple and influences a lot of later stuff. I would say in a modern time, this is probably the standard deck. Now, one last tarot deck that I want to throw into this list that I think is a very interesting one. And for some reason, I hear this all the time from people where they're very intimidated by Crowley's work. It's hard to say why. You know, I know that there was the defamation case that happened with the Golden Dawn in the British court system. And they had published a whole bunch of, you know, works about how Crowley was the most evil man to have ever lived. And some of that comes down to the fact that, you know, he was a bisexual man living in Britain at a time where that was illegal. And some of it ties into his own personality and his personal character clashes with others. By no means would I make him out to be perfect, but it is really interesting to see people now steer away from the deck that he produced in 1938 to 1942, because they're intimidated by his works. I have heard people say out on the street at social events and things like that, I've heard people make the claim that Aleister Crowley's Thoth deck is evil, or that it's like bad, or, you know, things like that. And I think it's a really funny claim. First off, I also want to make sure that the artist for this particular deck gets plugged the same way. And it's kind of a similar situation where Crowley gets a lot of the credit, but the painter, in this case also a woman, doesn't get as much credit for the time that they spent in that artwork. Now, the relationship between Crowley and the artist, her name was Lady Freda Harris. And Freda Harris was, again, also an occultist, was working closely with Crowley. The relationship between Crowley and Harris as they created the Thoth deck was a little bit more directly collaborating than in the case of Waite's deck and Pamela Coleman Smith, because Crowley was saying, hey, I would like a painting for this card. It will have these color tones. It will have this particular image in the background. It will have these particular things. And then Pamela would, Fred Harris would go ahead and paint something. And then sometimes he would ask for edits, and sometimes he would reject it entirely, which is why there are, what, three different depictions of the Magus card, which takes the role of the Magician card in Crowley's Thoth deck. The original paintings have survived to this day, as I understand. Eventually, they get exhibited into a gallery, and as I understand, a lot of them are now in personal collections. It was a six-month-long project of getting the cards originally painted, and was what they set on the books. They were like, it's going to be 6 months, we're going to sit down, we're going to pop these out, the deck's going to be done. 6 months to do this. And this six-month project ended up taking 5 years to complete. And I will be completely honest. As I have said, I will not paint Crowley out to be a saint by any means. I imagine that from what I understand of these two individuals, I imagine Crowley was a lot of the problem. He was very particular on a lot of different things and had a vision that, you know, to be fair to him, he had a very specific vision that he was trying to accomplish. And so they went back to do cards over and over again. There were some issues with scheduling and all sorts of things. This six-month project took 5 years. So the paintings, I'm not sure if they are. I'm under the impression that some of them are in private collections, but that the great majority of them, it might be the entire collection, but I'm pretty sure it's the great majority of them are at the Warburg Institute in London to this day. Now, unfortunately, neither Lady Frieder Harris nor Crowley ever actually lived to see the deck published. The first full publication was done by the Ordo Templi Orientis in 1969. And those decks are still floating around. The OTO made the first couple of these decks were in like a white box, and you can see like the OTO layman on it, and it came with a little booklet. Actually, I have one of the booklets on my desk right now. Hang on. Yeah, instructions for Aleister Crowley's Thoth deck. They produced them several times. There was the initial one in 19... what did I just say? I just had it in front of me. 1969. And then later, Wasserman, James Wasserman, published in... Does this actually say? I want to say his was in the close to 80s. It was 78 that he published one of those. There was eventually that deck made its way to the copyrights of U.S. Games and things like that. But Crowley did publish a book to go along with the deck, and in the book, the paintings were included of the specific cards. Now, similar to the Rider-Waite deck, Crowley's deck is very much based on the Golden Dawn teachings, and I would argue that he goes way, way harder than other individuals on trying to make sure that each one of the cards is as Kabbalistically aligned as possible. To the point that if you look in the background of a lot of cards and then you cross-reference those images with like the Kabbalistic Tree of Life associations for different plants and different animals and the colors that are associated to certain energies and those types of things, they really, really pushed that to its maximum. To the point that there are some cards that... If you get the really old versions that have really, really good color in them, you can actually see where they've used all of the scales of color from the Kabbalistic Tree of Life in order to fill in a lot of the details for the artwork. Or if they couldn't do that, they would actually take one color of paint that is one color, another color of paint that is another associated color, mix them together in a certain ratio in order to fill in certain details. So there was a great deal of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life wrapped into these cards. Something else that's really interesting to mention is that Lady Frieder Harris was, she had synesthesia, which is a brain condition that individuals' senses overlap a little bit. And I think it started to become kind of mainstream. We've heard a lot more about it. There's been a lot of interest in it since the emergence of psychedelics, where there's this idea of like individuals whose brains naturally, they can like see colors and images with sounds, like music, for example, was a really big one for Lady Frieder Harris. Or hearing the tones of colors might be an example. Those types of things. And her artwork, she painted and drew quite a bit. You can actually find a lot of her stuff that's outside of just this one particular deck. So knowing that that's there, reading through Thoth Tarot deck, or the Book of Thoth, and looking through the images on the tarot deck, it is really interesting to see how her mind will warp images in certain types of perspectives. The classic example for this like space-time warp thing that she paints a lot of times is in the Chariot card. Because in the Chariot card, you see from the front, you see the character. And then he's holding this weird swirly thing in front of him, which is the liquid inside the cup that he's holding. He's holding like a goblet, according to the depiction, the description of the card. But her mind has like shifted so that you can see it from the top down, even though he's holding it in front of him. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff that gets that comes from her personal interpretation. She also did quite a few paintings and drawings on like certain musical pieces that are really interesting to look at, of like her personal visions as she sat down and listened to a particular piece of music. So her artwork is fantastic. Definitely take some time and dig through it. But back to some of the Kabbalistic associations, they went very, very far with that. Anytime you see anything that's recognizable in one of the Thoth cards, take a second, look at it in detail. They also, a lot of times, Crowley would take a card that's like the Minor Arcana, and he would say, have you noticed how the forces that are present in this particular card are related to, I don't know, Mars and Sagittarius, for example, you know? And so they would draw a Mars symbol and a Sagittarius symbol in the background so that you could see how this particular interpretation unfolds a little bit into these planetary and zodiacal correspondences. Strongly suggest digging through those decks and taking a look. I will also say there are a few notable changes to cards in Crowley's deck. The major changes is that, you know, Crowley was very, very tied into the concepts of Thelema. And Thelema is stepping away from the old Aeon religion. And so there are several cards that, because of going back to Triumphi and going back to Terracini and those types of things, were tied into religious concepts with like the Catholic Church, with like the Pope card, or the Judgment Day card, or the House of God card. There were Christian concepts that were in some of the artwork and interpretations. And so Crowley goes through and changes some of those for the Thelemic concepts. And so some examples of those trump cards being modified are things like the old Aeon card instead of the Judgment card. Is it instead of Judgment? Yeah. Or the Judgment card becoming the Aeon card? I think it became the Aeon card. The Justice card becoming Adjustment instead of Justice. Still depicted very, very similarly, still holding a lot of its same ideas as far as the interpretation of that card, but now the artwork and theme being updated for a later religious ideology. The World card gets updated to the Universe because now we're far enough into the discovery of the scientific world that we now have this concept of the universe and it taking the same place as the world would have when these cards were first starting to come out. So there's a lot of those types of things. There's also a change in between the Rider-Waite deck and the Thoth deck that I think is really, really important to understand why it happens. And also, nobody seems to point this out or really even notice because it's very subtle. So the Golden Dawn taught a very interesting thing with the Kabbalistic tree and the breakdown of the tarot cards, which was that there are these two particular cards that they fit perfectly on the tree if you flip them. If you flip one with the other, they perfectly fit. And it was kind of like this big secret in the Golden Dawn that the reason is the Strength card and the Justice card. It really kind of breaks down into that. Is that the Justice card was always, since antiquity, depicted as someone holding scales, and the Strength card was a woman and a lion. And if you just put the tarot cards in order, the trump cards down on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, all of them seem to fit the Kabbalistic association, except for those two, because the justice card would fall on Leo, and the card with a lion would fall on Libra. And so if you just swap those two cards, now the image on the card fits the image of that zodiac. And so they had published that as a great mystery, as a very interesting thing. And it caused a whole bunch of discussion as to how that imbalances the rest of the zodiac and all sorts of stuff. But the reason why I bring it up is because when Arthur Edward Waite publishes the Rate Wider deck, he numbers them as they were numbered in antiquity. But when Aleister Crowley numbers his Thoth deck, he numbers them as they were taught in the Golden Dawn. And so if you're using certain decks and you're just following that number system, that swap, knowing that that swap has happened, is a pretty important change, I think, to be aware of. And then there's one last change that the Thoth deck makes. There is an incredible overlap between the interpretations of the tarot cards and the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And Crowley fine-tunes that interpretation with the Kabbalah. There are a couple of cards that the meanings were kind of similar to other meanings, or were not really, really profoundly interesting on the tarot or on the Kabbalah. And so he had modified the meanings of a few cards to better align with where it would positionally fall in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. They're minor changes. It almost always happens. His changes to the major arcana are all very, very obvious because he's relabeled cards. His changes to the minor arcana are usually very, very subtle changes in order to make it fit better with the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. So, interesting deck for sure. So, that is our historical breakdown of the timeline coming to modern mystery schools. And I want to take a second and talk a little bit, very briefly, about what tarot has become today. You know, it starts off as this Italian playing card game, makes its way into these mystery schools, and these deep teachings start to emerge from it. And then today, there are so many different types of tarot decks. Excluding oracle decks entirely, there are so many types of tarot decks that are available. Different artist interpretations, different themes, those types of things, that I was actually unable, and if somebody finds this number, please send it to me, because now my curiosity is burning. I was unable to find the number of tarot decks that are produced now. I don't think we know how many tarot decks individually there are in the world. We can make some pretty big guesses, and that to me is fascinating, that tarot still to this day is so lively that and has touched the interest of so many people with artistic talent and the business know-how to get a deck created. I visited one website as a part of creating this podcast episode. And on that single tarot website where they sold just, they were really big on it. I don't remember if it was like tarot.com or something. I can't remember what it was. It was some very large dealer of tarot decks online. That one single tarot site that I visited had over 500 unique tarot decks and then another 500 unique oracle decks. So assuming that they don't have every tarot deck available, which I think is a fair assumption, you are talking about thousands of different individual, if not more than that, maybe it could potentially be tens of thousands of different artistic interpretations of the tarot. We know a little bit more about the Rate Wider deck in specific, on its stats, how far it has spread. There are roughly 100 million weight rider decks estimated worldwide. It tarot decks themselves are a $1.2 billion industry in 2023. And one of the things that I was very curious about as we looked into that industry and how large that industry has really become is that growing or is it diminishing? And one of the things that I found really interesting was that where the previous year, 2022 to 2023, there was a 3.5% increase on the amount of money going through tarot card production. So I do believe that tarot cards are not on their way out. This tradition is, if anything, growing. Or the entire group of people that's practicing it have all become fanatic collectors, which there's probably some truth to that. I know I have quite a few decks. it's interesting to see so much growth and such a lively tradition. So many different interpretations. I had a really fun time. Recently we did a tarot social. Instead of doing like a class and talking about the specifics on anything, we did like a social night. We just invited everybody out. It was a public event at a public event center. And people just kind of, you know, showed up, ate some snacks together, and talked about tarot. And one person brought an entire box of all of their different decks. They really enjoyed, like, just all the different artwork. And I'm not sure if they were... It seemed as if they were not actively reading out of all of these decks. Many of them, they were still in order. And, you know, you could look through them and see the cool interpretations. And we had a lot of fun with that, of like sitting next to somebody who's looking through a different deck and being like, oh, look how cool this card and the posture here is really similar to this. I wonder what their inspiration was there. So I do think that tarot is a lively tradition that will continue on for hopefully many more hundreds of years. Well, that is going to conclude our episode on the history of tarot. Soon we will produce an episode that talks more about some of those cool correspondences that we were talking about with the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, and some of the interpretations of cards, some of those, you know, some of the more specifics on the divinatory practice and how one might go about that. But in the meantime, I hope you guys have fun with it and good luck.
Thanks for listening to the Whitewood Podcast. This show is made possible by our Patreon members. You can find us on Twitter at Whitewood Show and on Facebook at Whitewood Podcast. For links to all our social media and information about our Patreon, visit us at whitewoodpodcast.com.